So, occasionally people have asked me about my sabbatical, and at various times I've shared some things already. But one of the questions I get is, you know, what sort of changes that I've made in my life or seen in my life as a result of getting these 3.5 months of sabbatical this summer? And there are plenty of things I can share, and you'll get to hear more over time. But this morning I want to talk a little bit about my decision to stay off of Twitter, which may seem pretty small or simple, but is not so much. As I was getting near to the end of my sabbatical, I was thinking a lot about my relationship with technology. Going 3.5 months completely screenless gave me some freedom and some real perspective. It was both incredibly hard, but also so good. I liked what I was experiencing during my sabbatical, being free from screens. But I also knew that it wasn't entirely sustainable when I came back. That I would have to figure out how to navigate screens again to some extent. But what I realized was I actually didn't have any wisdom to draw from. I couldn't identify anyone who was engaging with media and technology from a position of strength. Almost everyone I know, and I think we could all sort of confirm this as we think about our own lives and the people that we live with, we're all just sort of trying to not get swallowed up by our devices and by the endless entertainment options that are available to us. But I was seeing a counselor during my sabbatical, and he put me onto a book called Digital Minimalism that helped me to think wisely about all of this stuff. And so I just want to share one aspect of this this morning. The thing that compelled me to drop Twitter from my life, and there are other things, but this one specifically. And so what this book, Digital Minimalism, introduced me to is something called the slow news movement. Slow news. We live in a day at a time that is completely obsessed with breaking news. And I don't think I actually have to say much about the intensity of the 24-hour news cycle for you to have an immediate sense with me of what I'm talking about. For me, and this may not be the same for you, Twitter was one of my primary sources for breaking news, for knowing what was going on in the world at any given moment. And this obsession with breaking news is rooted probably in different places for everyone. But for me, it's about a need to know immediately about anything that's going on in the world. And the lie that knowing about these things meant I was somehow engaged in or doing something about them. And people who study the effects of this phenomenon identify two major concerns with our access to instantaneous news. The first is anxiety, and the second is misinformation. So rates of anxiety among Americans just continue to rise. And while there seems to be a number of causes for this rise, at least one of them appears to be the constant access that we all have to every bad thing that is happening anywhere at all times. Tie this to the fact that we are less and less able to do anything about most of the news that we hear, and it's this like perfect storm for constantly feeling paralyzed in the midst of heightened fear. Social psychologists continue to demonstrate that knowing a specific story. All we have to know is one specific story about something bad that happened to someone, somewhere, at some time. And this increases our own sense that that thing could happen to us. And even if the likelihood is nearly zero. And this is why parents are often afraid of their kids being abducted. Even though it is a near statistical improbability, but we've all seen faces on milk cartons. Maybe not everyone, those are kind of an older thing. But the parents who are afraid of their kids being abducted saw faces on milk cartons. And we all know the name of at least one kid who was kidnapped somewhere at some time. So if anxiety is this issue, so also is misinformation. Breaking news stories are almost always filled with some sort of inaccuracies or incomplete information. And the speed that it takes to be the first to break any story means that information hasn't been vetted as well as it needs to be. And since we tend to be hooked on breaking news, by the time journalists have done the work to determine what actually happened, we rarely go back and check our information. And we've moved on to the latest news cycle, the newest news cycle. And so this slow news movement is actually about making a deliberate choice to eliminate breaking news from your media diet. Which actually means that you have to do some things with your technology that's the source of this breaking news. The notifications that pop up on your phone all the time. It's about intentionally selecting a few long-form, reputable journals or sources. It's about setting aside dedicated time to read and to try to understand what's happening in the world. So I was challenged, I was inspired by this approach to knowing what's going on. But more than that, I recognized the wisdom of God in it. When I looked at what was good, what good I was getting from Twitter, I realized that it actually didn't come close to the scales being balanced in terms of the bad that I was getting. Not only is Twitter a source of anxiety and misinformation for me and for others, but it is also an intense distraction for me, often pulling me from things that I wanted to be doing. On top of that, it was making me more reactive and less able to think through things in a slower way. And so wisdom called me to step away from Twitter so that I could be a better human being. All sorts of people use Twitter for all kinds of different reasons than I was using it. And for some, it could be wise to use it, but I discovered that's not me. Twitter was keeping me from being the father and the husband that God made me to be. It was also keeping me from being the best pastor that I could be. And you heard this last week as we considered Genesis 1 through 3, but God made human beings to be rulers over the earth, to care for and to bring order to our gardens. And in order to do this work well, we need God's wisdom, which it turns out isn't a one-time gift where like God pours all wisdom through a funnel into the top of your head and now you have it all. Wisdom comes to us bit by bit. It's learned. We grow in it. It develops in us as we walk with God. Wisdom is about how we live well in this world. And wisdom involves every part of our lives. Wisdom has something to say to every single part of our lives. It involves the technology we use, the media that we enjoy, the social media sites that we post on and scroll through, the news that we consume. Wisdom involves our friendships. the relationships that we have with our family members, our romantic relationships. It involves, wisdom involves our money and our homes and our cars and all of our stuff. It involves who we marry and why we marry them. Wisdom involves our careers and our hobbies and our habits and our vices. And the truth is, we never fully arrive at wisdom, but we are always moving toward wisdom or away from it. And this is why we're gonna spend our morning with King Solomon, who we've already read a little bit about this morning. And so if you have your Bibles, if you would open them to 1 Kings, this is where we get his story. So you'll wanna open to 1 Kings. And if last week was about this big idea that God has made us to rule and he gives us the wisdom to rule well, well then this week is kind of a deep dive into one of the Bible's central examples. And we're gonna look at what happens when a real ruler moves toward wisdom. And then what happens when this same ruler moves away from wisdom. Obviously, the scope of Solomon's life is a little bit bigger than ours. He had a kingdom to rule over, and we have much smaller kingdoms. But Solomon still stands as an encouragement for us, and also as a warning. Our domains, the gardens that God has made us responsible for will flourish or they will wither based on our relationship with wisdom. So Solomon's story is told in the Bible in this like beautifully complex way, capturing the good and the bad of his life. And so if you've got your Bibles open to 1 Kings, we'll start in chapter 4. And I wanna show you an example of this, of the good and the bad of Solomon's life. And so let's start by looking at verse 25. We hear this amazing picture of what the kingdom of Solomon has become. Chapter 4, 1 Kings, chapter 4, verse 25, we read, "And Judah and Israel," these were the two halves of the kingdom, "lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba." In other words, from the northernmost point to the southernmost point. "Every man under his vine and under his fig tree all the days of Solomon." This is an epic picture of life under Solomon's reign. Every man under his vine, under his fig tree. Might not immediately resonate with us. We don't tend to think of the good life as a life where we hang out under a vine or under a fig tree. In fact, I ate my first fig this week. So fig trees aren't even like a part of like my ordinary life. And so this might be similar for you, where you go under his vine and under his fig tree. Huh, interesting. If your imagination is shaped by the scriptures, there's so much more happening here because this imagery is from the Garden of Eden. The prophets are going to use this very same language to talk about the coming of God's peace, the coming of God's final restoration, the new heavens and the new earth, that when God's peace comes, when all things are made right, people will rest under their own vine and fig tree. In one breath, we're told that Solomon's reign looks like Eden on earth. Eden already was on earth. Heaven on earth. Can you imagine being told that because of your rule over your garden, because of your ability, your life of taking care of your garden, your domain, that those who experience it experience paradise? like coming into your home, coming into your workplace, that it's like being in Eden. I mean, we're told that it looks like a beautiful and secure garden ruled by a good and wise caretaker. That's what life is like under Solomon. And then we read the next verse. Verse 26. Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. Okay, so Solomon's got lots and lots of horses and chariots. So many horses and chariots. So what? Aren't horses and chariots just standard fare for kings and kingdoms, for mighty kingdoms? Isn't 40,000 horses and 12,000 horsemen just a clear way to point out Solomon's military might, the way that God has blessed him and his kingdom? Yes, but horses and chariots were not supposed to be part of the military equation for God's people. That in earlier scriptures, God has made it clear to his people that they would not ever need the weapons of empire, that they would not ever need a standing army or a dynamic military strategy. No matter the size of the enemy's armies, no matter their neighbor's military strength, if the Israelites walked closely with their God, God would be their strength and their shield. He declared to them again and again. And if you go back to the Garden of Eden, God told Adam and Eve not to take the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. Later, God will tell the Israelites that they are not to take from the tree of military knowledge. Everyone else around you might be building up armies and amassing horses and chariots and striving to be on the top of everyone else, but God told the Israelites these were off limits for them. The world's wisdom is not God's wisdom. Life for Adam and Eve would not be found in the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And in the same way, peace for Israel would not be found in the world's political and military wisdom. This is how the story of Solomon is told. In one verse, we're told one thing about Solomon and his reign. And sometimes in the very next verse, like in this instance, we're told something very different about Solomon and his reign. And we're left to wonder, what do we do with these two verses side by side? And one of the challenges of reading Solomon's story is that the narrator almost never tells us whether Solomon is doing a good thing or a bad thing. The narrator doesn't give us the moral of the story. And this is actually part of the beauty of the story. It's actually part of the invitation of the story, drawing us in so that we become active participants, so that we begin to ask the question, wait, what is good and what is bad? So that we actually develop the ability to discern within the life of Solomon what honors God and what doesn't. Solomon can only act as an example for us. And we can only learn from Solomon if we are seeking and growing in God's wisdom. If we're not seeking and growing in God's wisdom, then the story is just going to confirm everything we already think about the way the world works. When you read Solomon's story for the very first time, if you read it straight through, what you find is that it sounds like a brag sheet. And this would be common in the ancient world, but also today. It actually sounds like what you would hear today if you were to turn on Fox News and catch any of the president's people talking about the president, anything the president has done, complete praise and affirmation. And it was the same 4 years ago. If you were to turn on MSNBC and you were listening to them talking about the work of the president, everything they do is wonderful, the people declared. No decision could be wrong, could be second-guessed. Their crowd size is bigger than anyone else's crowd size. As you read through 1 Kings, if this is all you know, it sounds like Solomon has never done a thing wrong. And it's only once you get to the end of the story, chapter 11, which, if you would turn there with me, that we actually read some judgment, some clarity about what Solomon has been up to. And so chapter 11, starting verse 1, we read, "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women." So this is the end of the Solomon story. And this is the second time that we find out that Solomon loves. The first instance is at the beginning of his story when we're told that he loved the Lord. And we find this tension. The beginning of his story loves the Lord, and the end of his story, he loves these foreign women. Along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you. For surely they will turn away your heart after their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. Dang. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. So one way that people have read Solomon's story is this, that Solomon lived out his entire life a good guy. It was just when he got old, maybe he got a little lazy, suddenly he decided he loved women a bit more than he could keep a handle on. But it was at the end of his life, it was after everything else, and it's just a story of not finishing well. Some people have tried to read Solomon's story this way. But we're told in the verses that follow that there were other things that Solomon was up to. We're told that Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord. That Solomon built places of worship for other gods. We're told that he forced Israelites into indentured servitude. And he oppressed his own people. So much so that when his son takes over the throne, the kingdom, the people come to him, beg for him to release them from the oppression that they had experienced under their father, his father Solomon. It's a little bit different of a picture, right? See, these aren't just things that happen when Solomon gets old. These are things that are developing in him throughout his whole ministry, service, life, rulership, reign. And these are clues that we actually need to go back and reread Solomon's story again. How we read Solomon's story actually says something about how attuned our ears and our hearts are to God's wisdom. Because when we do go back and we reread Solomon's story, we often don't see what's off. We don't see what's wrong. We read the story of a powerful king amassing armies, amassing so much gold that he starts making totally worthless stuff with it, like bonus stairs for his throne and shields made of gold, because those are real effective. He just keeps gaining. He just keeps collecting. while his borders keep expanding. And we read, our default assumption is God's blessing him. This is good. In our minds, this is wisdom. God is blessing Solomon, and so he has everything anybody could ever want. He is the model. But the clue for us about how to read Solomon's story is in that little passage I just read for you from chapter 11. And in that, we heard this phrase, concerning which the Lord said to his people. The foreign wives were unwise. Not just because God said, don't marry foreign wives, but God actually told the Israelites that foreign wives would turn their hearts to other gods. He was helping them understand why foreign wives were a bad idea for people who wanted to live lives entirely devoted to him. And likewise, the scriptures are full of these sorts of instructions and explanations. And this really is the key to rereading Solomon's story. We need to have God's instructions and his explanations on our minds when we read this story. It's only then that we begin to notice what is amiss. It's only then that we begin to notice the excess of wealth. And we begin to notice the horses and chariots, and those strike us as weird. And then we notice the slave labor. And we notice the abuse of power. And all of the things that God has commanded, given commands and reasons for avoiding. I don't know if you guys have done much reading in this area, but it's fascinating to me that Solomon is one of the reasons, one of the rationales that many early American Christians felt justified in enslaving Africans. Since 1 Kings tells us that Solomon never enslaved his own people, he only enslaved foreigners. He put his own people into a form of indentured servitude, which was different. But since Solomon was blessed by God, God must be cool with this. I've heard people point to Solomon as their rationale for why Christians should be able to accumulate huge fortunes. Who would be against God's blessing, I was asked. And so it turns out, as we read this story, Solomon isn't our example for how to be wise. He is a model for us. And starting at a place of humility and recognizing that to rule well, we need God's wisdom. And he humbles himself and he asks for the right thing. He starts out in the right place. But Solomon is our case study in scripture that actually trains us to see how wise or unwise we are. And Solomon helps us learn and grow in wisdom. See, the problem with Solomon's practice of wisdom is that he resorts over and over again to the world's definition of wisdom, the world's categories for what is wise. He looks to the other kings of other kingdoms and how they rule. He looks to his neighbors for wisdom regarding war. And he looks to his neighbors for how to build a kingdom. And I have a feeling that we actually might resonate with this. Like, how many meetings have you been in with other Christians where someone is trying to convince you of a certain course of action by saying, well, this is just how they do it in the business world? Not that we might not have something to learn from the business world, but that is the basis upon which we should make our decision. This is how it's done in the world. This is how they do it. This is how people date in the world. So this is how we date. This is how people get married. This is how people raise their children. This is how people handle conflict or use their computers or use their time. How often do we start from, well, this is what's normal. This is what everyone does. It's amazing, right? Among Christians, how often the world is our point of reference. We do things because they make sense in the world we live in, the world that has discipled us, the world that has made us a product of itself. We read Solomon's story and we see nothing wrong with it because it makes sense according to the world that we live in. It makes perfect sense according to the patterns of our world. The only problem is Jesus. He's always messing things up. He comes along and he announces something greater than Solomon is here. Which should strike us as odd because we just heard this morning God in Solomon's dream say that no one before Solomon or after would be greater. Except for God himself in the flesh. And this comes from the Gospels, Matthew 12:42, where we hear Jesus say this. And what Jesus is doing is he's talking to the scribes, he's talking to the Pharisees, and he's telling them that they misunderstand their own scriptures. They misunderstand these figures that they hold up with high regard. They are misreading them. And one of the scriptures that they are misreading is the story of Solomon. But it's okay, Jesus says, because one greater than Solomon is here. Jesus is talking about himself. And this is amazing. Depending on your orientation to wisdom, you can actually read what Jesus says two different ways. So either Solomon was the richest, most powerful, most God-blessed king in the world, that the world has ever seen, the king who expanded Israel's boundaries the furthest, who was overall a fantastic king, fell at the end, but let's not worry about that, which means Jesus is going to be a king just like, but better than Solomon, which means he's going to expand Israel's boundaries even further. He's going to be richer and more powerful and wiser than Solomon. But unlike Solomon, Jesus won't fall for any of those pesky foreign women. That's one way to read it. Spoiler, I think the second way is better. The other way is that the way Jesus is king is fundamentally greater than Solomon in his reign. So, Jesus will be king, but not with slaves, nor with an army, and not with a treasury, and not with a harem. Jesus will reject Solomon's power in order to be the king who lays down his life for his enemies. Jesus will take the form of a slave himself in order to serve his people. Jesus will die unjustly at the hands of soldiers while telling his followers to put down their swords. Jesus will tell people to give away all of their wealth, offering eternal rewards in heaven earned through death and suffering. Jesus trades in Solomon's harem for a great cloud of witnesses who follow Jesus and who imitate him in worshiping the Father by laying down their lives in love for enemies. The scriptures where God tells kings how to rule should be enough for us to read the Solomon story and reject him as an ideal king. However, when Jesus comes along, we are given this even deeper and clearer insight about how we are to rule on the earth. The kings of Israel can help us learn wisdom, but only as they point us to Jesus, who is our wisdom. This means that we can't look to David or Solomon or Moses or Abraham to show us what wisdom looks like. Each of them, in their failures, they point us to the need for the perfect king. They turn our eyes toward Jesus, and when we fix our eyes upon him, there we see true wisdom. Jesus is our lens for determining what is truly good and bad. Which means that any time that we are trying in this life to figure out how to live well, in any of those areas I talked about earlier, because wisdom touches every part of our lives, before we say, well, this is how they do it in the business world. Well, this is how they do it in this magazine that I'm reading. Well, this is how. Before that, we as followers of Jesus are learning to cultivate a new instinct. A new habit that says, what did Jesus do? Who was Jesus? And how does Jesus reveal to us God's wisdom for this moment? And of course, the moment we fix our eyes on Jesus, we can't help but follow him to the cross. Paul tells us that it is the cross that is the wisdom of God. Wisdom, of course, that was shameful for Jews and foolish for Gentiles. And so we acknowledge that our efforts to seek wisdom and walk wisely might get ridiculed as shameful or foolish. But the beauty is that every step toward wisdom is a step with Jesus. And he invites us this morning to come and to be with him and to walk with him. And so again, to keep our lives, to keep our desire for wisdom centered in the right place, we gather around the table that he invited us to. The place where he reminded us again, my wisdom is not of this world. My kingdom is not of this world. So seek me, because I am the way, the truth, and the life.